Are you an athlete, athlete in business, professional helping athletes, or an entrepreneur? Join the Athletes Making Moves course, which launched March 21st of this year, helping athletes and business owners like you find and reshape their identity for success, uncover their purpose, understand the building blocks of business, and begin creating and implementing a legacy that will pay dividends for generations to come. And guess what? A portion of the proceeds are being donated to the Alzheimer's Association in the honor of my late grandmother, Glovine Smith, as a token and appreciation of her love and investment into my life. What are you waiting for? It's time to make moves. So register now at athletesmakingmoves.com and select the course tab to get started. See you soon. Ciao.
Welcome to What Are You Sporting About Podcast, a podcast about business, employment, sports, and entertainment to help educate, support, and guide you to your next level. Here's your host, attorney Savania DeBarros.
Excited to be before you today. Look, this is my very first time broadcasting all the way from Lisbon, Portugal, so super kudos to me. And as you know, I'm not in my normal original place where I normally record. So you guys may have to just bear with me on some things that may be a little different, that kind of may seem out of the ordinary. So as you already know, my name is Savania DeBarros, the protector of athletes, also the founder and principal attorney of the S.L. DeBarros Law Firm, where we represent business owners, athletes in business, and employees. I'm super excited because I've been trying to communicate with Miss Samantha for quite a while and have finally pinned her down to get her on this cast because I feel like she just is such an amazing person. I want her to share a little bit more about her and how she ended up founding She Media, which is absolutely amazing, and she's doing amazing things with this particular company. So Samantha, go ahead and tell us a little bit more about who you are and She Media, and then we'll jump and dive further into the conversation.
Let's go. Okay, thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I'm sorry that I'm hard to pin down. That's the general.
You're just a busy overcommitment. Lady. Everyone wants you. That's all.
No,
that's all.
God, no. That's my kids don't want me at all. But So I am CEO of She Media, and we represent over 2,000 independent websites and content creators who are endeavoring to monetize the content they produce and to make their living that way. We also own four operating sites: She Knows, which is parenting and health; Stylecaster, which is fashion, beauty, entertainment; Soaps.com, which is all drama; Hello Flow, which is women's health and normalizing women's sexuality; and then Blog Her, which is one of the oldest and most vibrant conference series for women's leadership. So we get to play in a lot of zones, and I get to play with athletes pretty often because many women athletes are also big content creators and social media mavens and have legitimate independent brands that they're looking to monetize. So that's me. That's what I'm up to.
That is amazing. And guys, as you know, if you've seen me post a lot, I'm in Lisbon with my 4-year-old toddler. So like I said, bear with me because some things are happening over here in the background. But you know, I almost kind of feel like that's part of being a woman, and definitely a mother, is having to deal with those unexpected circumstances and truly navigate through them. So Samantha, I met you actually at the Women's Sports Forum, an organization that I helped Dr. Gregory Charlotte to launch, and you gave a keynote there. So that was my very first time seeing you, learning about you and all of the impact that you are making. What brought you to, you know, wanted to create this type of media company to help women and diversify and normalize some of the conversations that I feel like are not normally had for us, you know, to really help women thrive in every aspect of life?
Well, I think that probably a convergence of things, you know, being a woman in business myself, coming up through technology and digital media. You know, I was privy to some of the challenges and some of the unique circumstances of being a woman in the room, and over time became more aware that I had the privilege of being a white woman in the room, which was kind of one degree of marginalization, but there were so many, many more layers for some of my colleagues. Became a mother, saw how poorly designed so much of business is for parents in general, and how many women step away, and you know, women in particular, step away from their careers during that time period and are saddled with guilt all the time for being, you know, mediocre at either work or parenting or both. So all of those things were banging around in my head when I moved into women's media in general and started thinking about the benefit of the current technologies that exist or have existed now for 20 years that enable women and enable independent people to produce their own content and to create a living off of from that. And then I thought about, you know, my team thinks about curation of content and that there is content in the world that unites us or challenges us in a good way, empowers, inspires, informs, but and challenges. We like debate. And then there's content that is divisive, you know, perpetuating of hatred, of stereotypes. And there's very little curation on the social platforms like Facebook, Instagram, you know, on and on, you know, Snap, Twitter, we could go on, because they act as platforms and they thus, you know, can issue accountability for the veracity of the content or the impact of the content. So, and in that zone, I speak of fake news. So we thought She Media could really curate a great batch of content makers and give them space to earn. We have to make a margin on that. We are a for-profit company, but we could make more money for the content creators, you know, bloggers, social media, writers, videographers. And we could do that while also creating a business that was scalable, because the more sites we bring on board, the more our technology is able to scale. So it kind of made sense in the moment of this confluence of the social media age, independently produced content, you know, recognizing how deficient the social platforms are in terms of, you know, attentiveness to quality and impact of content, and then, you know, being a frustrated probably mom. So yeah, I guess all that.
I totally get it. So here's something I want to ask you, is more a business question based. Because for a lot of women, and especially being a group that is traditionally marginalized or lacking in resources and education, it's hard to know when and how to actually scale a company. Now, She Media for you was acquired in 2018 by another company. So as a female-owned brand, as someone who owns multiple sister brands and helps other companies to scale and build their businesses, you know, what are some tips that you can give to females who are women in business, who possibly even have been approached with an offer to, you know, to buy out their business, keep them on? You know, how did you navigate the waters, you know, when that was presented to you?
I think it's, I've learned a lot from just, you know, 25 plus years in digital and technology by acquiring other companies or being, I think this was the first time that my company was really acquired, but I, as part of other companies that I, where I was either co-founding or early management, we bought a lot of companies, and there are, you're always giving something up, I think, and gaining something. Consolidation of media is causing a lot of independent publishers to give up quite a lot in pursuit of, you know, sustainability. I didn't think I would want to stay with She Media post-acquisition at all. And I was given an opportunity to really use the resources of Penske Media, which is our acquirer, the resources of the expanded tech and, you know, and legal and HR and all sorts of things that I'm not good at, and to use those additional resources to really continue to serve our users and the publishers who we represent better and better. And it's working. So I keep staying, and I love working on startups. I've never been like the standalone founder. And so if you are, I have so much respect for that, you know, degree of, you know, risk confidence and, you know, whether you're faking it sometimes or, you know, feeling it all the time. I think it's really hard to feel like you know, comfortable in that seat. So I don't have perfect advice, except that you often have a gut on when it's right to sell or right to continue to scale on your own. I've always had a very strong trusted group of close friends who are also really good in the industries I've inhabited, and who can give me very strong feedback and do actual research with me and, you know, call me out if I'm making an easy choice. And then I always have a backup plan, or I try to. That might be just fear, but I always have an idea of what I will do if a business move doesn't work out as I'd hoped. Like, do I have an ability to retract and, you know, rethink, or am I jumping ship and, you know, starting something else or pursuing something else or taking a breather? So I think if we get so caught up in the end game, then it's just a very stressful way to live. And I think is doesn't allow us to look at the sum total of our careers and our impact, which makes each little decision seem a bit less dramatic if you can look at the whole continuity. But that's kind of a not very specific answer. See, Avenia.
No, I think it helped me. I mean, it works a lot. And I hope that people listening and watching this interview later recognizes the importance of, like you said, the gut check. So what is your first inclination about the offer that has been presented to you? But then there's also a matter of, okay, who are my trusted confidants? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I feel like when you excel in a way, it's easy to end up in crowds where not everybody has your best interests at heart. Mm-hmm. You know, and so then you kind of end up in a situation where you're around yes people, but are they giving you, you know, the real advice that you need to see if your gut is on par, or are you responding in a fearful way? You know, mm-hmm. is there a mindset challenge that's being presented to you versus, okay, this might not be something I need to do? Yeah. You know, and sometimes when an offer is presented, it could be a really good offer, mm-hmm. but that for me, it might not be for me, even though it's a really good offer.
Right. Great point. Yeah.
Yeah. So you really have to evaluate everything. Like, it's, you know, what would my life be like? How would I want my life to be if I accepted this offer? And would it change anything that I care about? Because if it does, then maybe, you know, maybe it's a no for me.
Yep. And that's a strong one. I think it's a great point. I think about, you know, profit and purpose, mm-hmm. you know, earning opportunity. And, you know, I care. I think a lot of women feel, I don't know, sadly, people in my generation are hesitant to say that earning money is a key priority. For me, it is. And, people sometimes say like, oh, it's so great you work and have a passion. I'm like, I work because I'm paying mortgage. I work because there's a lot of reasons I work there, not just because it's like fun. But I do love the work I get to do across myriad industries. And I think that you're right that we have to balance that profit and purpose and people and who do you want to be around and what's right for you. It's hard. I sometimes do try to, I remember now, like when I was switching from sustainability to women's interests, that I had like a spreadsheet where I was scoring different things that were important to me, like the people you surround yourself with, the tangible impact, the earning opportunity, the learning opportunity, you know, the even like location and family life. And because it kind of took me out of, you know, thinking too hard about the offer that the person who was making me the offer and feeling like that, feeling guilty if I didn't say yes, or it allowed me to be a little more cold and calculating. And I just liked seeing the score, like, because then I would go back and you question yourself, like, you're like, why did this job or this opportunity, this investment from someone else score so low? Like, was there something? And you're like, oh, it's because I'll never see my family. I forgot that part. Like, that's kind of important. My kids are at a certain age. So anyway, yeah, I'm with you. It's tricky, but having honest people around you who are willing to have uncomfortable confrontation with you is critical.
Very critical. I don't know if you know this, but there is a book that I wrote in 2020 called What Are You Sporting About? And part of that book, there's a chapter that says Mom and Them, because I'm from the country, from the South. So we always say, how's Mom and Them doing?
I just don't know that term.
Yeah. So part of that is, you know, part of that chapter is, you know, are our family and friends helping our process or are they hindering? And with that question is, are you yourself having those difficult conversations? So it kind of like flips things on its head for kind of from what we've been talking about versus your friends giving you the advice, but now mm-hmm. from, you know, the other side, the person who in their eyes have soared in a way that has reached this type of stardom or celebrity in their eyes, where they feel like, oh, you just got it. Samantha got it. She can do it, you know, but maybe you don't. It causes you to have a real uncomfortable conversation with people that you love and or admire to recognize, look, if you want something to happen long term, well, here's what we have to do now, because mm-hmm. that's the only way you're going to create that sustainability, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's over time. I was so, have been in my career, so excited and enthusiastic about every woman I met who was starting something and, you know, taking that big move, you know, out into the unknown. And one of my good friends who had, you know, had a show on MSNBC that was specifically about interviewing entrepreneurs and looking at how they were, you know, speccing out and then scaling their businesses. She was like, why do you think everybody should start a company? And I was like, I'm just so impressed by entrepreneurs. And she was like, a lot of people should not start companies. Like either the idea is not, the space is too competitive. Maybe the idea is not solid. I mean, that's a qualitative point, but maybe they are not going in a place in life where they are going to be able to commit the time. Maybe they're not structuring it right, or in a way, again, that this expert in her own right, you know, understood very well about, you know, business structure and investment and cap tables and how you set yourself up for success. So I had to think about that. I was like, why do I? I'm like, that's a great idea. Like, you know, purple bubble tea, like, even though there's so many other people who do the thing and it's going to be really low margin, you should do that. So I, you know, like flower arranging in the desert, I thought everything was so, I was so, again, impressed, I guess, by the people that I couldn't necessarily separate them from the idea and the business. And then I started asking as I got a little bit further along and started doing some angel investing. I was like, would I put my own money in this business? And if not, why? Even my own, like, not a lot, and if I wouldn't give over like an uncomfortable amount, like if I wouldn't give the amount that you give when you really only give it if you think it's going to come back, then why? And that was a much tougher filter. That ended up being, because I'm a conservative investor, but an enthusiastic kind of cheerleader and like problem solver. And I think so many women entrepreneurs are so impressive. So that was tricky. I was like, oh man, I wouldn't invest in this. And I know why I wouldn't. I know that it's, you know, too competitive of a space, or that I think the idea is not a product. It's more of a thing you can do on Facebook, or a community you can tack on to something else. And that's hard, because then you'd have to very carefully, if someone's seeking your advice and you respect and trust that person, I think you kind of have an obligation to tell them why you would not invest. And so what I've said is, like, I support you and I am willing to, like, help promote your product. I will put you on whatever stages I have access to. I'll even introduce you to investors, but I couldn't quite endorse and pitch investment in your company or at this stage, because I don't know how you're going to navigate the challenge of X, or I don't yet see this as a product. I see it as a concept. And at concept phase, without any proof, I don't think I or most people are going to invest, unless it's just straight up, we like that person and, you know, and are supporting the person blindly. So that I didn't start really doing. I didn't feel like that was, you know, my role until about maybe say 5 years ago, where I, you know, and it's not my favorite role. I much prefer when I really like a business and want to invest in it, but I or want to believe in its future success. But I'm often wrong too. So I only come with so much utility.
That is so good, because that has to be hard as an entrepreneur to have that conversation with someone else who you really want to win. Mm-hmm. And like you, I used to always feel like people should just start their own business.
Yeah.
But I realized it's not everyone that has that entrepreneur mindset. Right. You know, some people truly are meant to be employees, and that's cool. Right. Like, there's a place for everyone. You know, some people may have an awesome idea, but maybe they're not equipped in a way to really bring that idea to fruition. Mm-hmm. Maybe they are the type of people, you know, like music, songwriters.
Yeah.
You can't sing, but you can write the heck out of a song.
Right.
You can exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. You start thinking I should be doing the whole thing and, like, building the new sound system and the, you know, putting out, dropping the whole record. And it's, I think that in this culture, I agree that there's sort of a fluidity that's wonderful, because it's like people who can act might also be able to direct, to your point. People who are accountants might also have really creative ideas for scalable systems that could be packaged. Those are two very strange examples, but I think that that's wonderful that we're not pigeonholing in the American sort of entrepreneurial space. But I also think it sometimes leads us to, like, I'm going to found a company that does that instead of really pushing yourself and saying the only reason to start a company is not the only reason, but don't start a company if you can't envision not starting it. Like, only, it's like writing a book. Sometimes I've heard this from, I've never written a book, but I don't think I should write a book. Like, I don't think, you know, I think you should write a book, but I have done. But a friend of mine who's a repeat author was like, don't write a book unless you can't not write it. Like, you've got to have it so in you that you really need to put this narrative, this concept, this philosophy or story into a published form. Otherwise, you know, write a blog or do other things. Like, don't put yourself through the hell of, like, trying to publish and distribute and generate sales in such a competitive, you know, consumer
and it
content.
Is a lot. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I feel like anything, like, if you really have a true desire to do something, you should do it.
Right.
And to be frankly with you, I tell people this all the time, and I probably have said it on this podcast before. It was not in me to create a podcast. What was in me was to have these massive conversations around athletes starting businesses who were constantly ending up at the same place, you know, once their sport ended, with no guidance, no real, you know, support system behind them. I'm like, how can I have these conversations? What is the best route to have these conversations? And, you know, this was really
your means to an end. It. You couldn't.
Correct.
You needed to have the end. Yes. Like, you need the part to. And I think that's smart. Like, you're like, that's the vision mission. And now how do I get there? Like, what's my tactical plan? I think that's actually kind of the best way sometimes to start something. And I'm with you. I think women athletes, though, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what comes of sort of Web3 and the increased sort of fanship in a lot of women athletes that they independently own. that, you know, this is something that Alexis Ohanian, who's, you know, founder of Reddit and married to the goddess who is Serena Williams, he said on our stage at South by Southwest, he was like, women are just better at social content. Like, they're just better at it. They're more supportive and, you know, the more consistent that, I mean, it was a funny platitude, of course, but he can kind of get away with saying that, and, you know, has partial ownership of various teams, and was like, it's going to be women athletes who generate, you know, I mean, written large, who generate the most fanship as we get more and more into media that is not straight broadcast linear. And yeah, and I thought that was exciting. And that feels like a drive, like the those who are figuring that out, like how you give that platform to women athletes, because things are percolating in the right direction. And then back into what's the tactical plan? Like, are we going with individuals? Are we going with a narrative or around fair pay, or a narrative around being a mother and an athlete? Or, you know, I just think that the how is going to be really fun to unpack.
Yeah. And there's so many different ways to do that. As you were speaking, I was just thinking about the godlike power that women have, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. If you are someone who's spiritual and really believes in the divine divinity, you know, for God to have created something only women can create, yeah. you know, in that way.
That.
Yeah. And then to create something else on top of that, to mm-hmm. navigate and balance multiple things. To me, that is a godlike power. Mm-hmm. And so when I've seen female athletes, and especially those who somewhat like a phoenix have risen through all the ashes and all the crap that has been thrown on them and said about them, or the things that have happened behind closed doors, but they still have kept themselves together. You know, I personally don't know how you do that without having
your godly power. You're tougher than you're bringing with you as strength.
Yes. And
that's being once in the presence of having the great honor of interviewing Serena Williams, I was like, like you said, godlike. She's divine. It's one of those. And we've interviewed her husband also, and he's really smart. She's divine. Like, there's a big difference. And it is just like what you've been through already, what you've had to recover from and prove, and that kind of the fire you've walked through is like, you're going to be fine. Like, and we just need to make sure we're creating the business opportunity, because we want these people to thrive, because it'll be better for society, but they're going to be fine is what because they've already surmounted so much by the time you get to be an athlete with a capital A.
Yes, that is so true. So I'm going to shift a little bit. We've talked about business and we've talked a lot of business. We've talked about, you know, true trusted people in our circles to help us make decisions. What I'd like to know next from you, because I'm a licensed attorney and I love the law. And so this is a new thing this year, because I'm like, I really want to dig deep with folks and kind of see where their head is at. With creating your company and being involved in acquiring companies and everything else that comes with that, what has been the biggest challenge for you legally throughout your career?
Oh, wow. It's a good one. Right now, cannabis advertising. Whether you can advertise cannabis is really confusing, because it's very much about a specific disc, you know, like municipalities, and the ads show up and it's like, who are they being consumed by? You have to target really carefully. So that's a great area to go into. I think there's going to be a lot of interesting on the legal mm-hmm. challenges that I can't even understand yet on the blockchain as content becomes and transactions become increasingly transparent. I don't know what's going to happen with IP that's shared with lots and lots of people, but I'd say probably IP has been probably the most ongoing, just tricky area. If you look at social media, the content is utterly unowned by the individuals who make it, which makes me frustrated. and we're probably part of that in some way as a large media company now, you know, She Media plus all of Penske Media assets. We're really careful or actually quite loud about talking with creators, you know, whether it's, you know, a woman athlete or a an entrepreneur who's building a content business, to ensure that they own their own IP and that it can't be swiped from them based on an algorithmic change or something. Because otherwise you really can't get shut off and lose all that audience and reach and monetizable engagement. So IP and like really developing what I think about what's fair in that area. Others, I mean, now I think it's really interesting. This is, I don't know if this is a, I think there are legal questions around this, is hiring diversity and how, yeah, I guess this is kind of adjacent, like there's law, there should be or is law involved here, but we're looking at diversity hiring as, you know, something that I would say is a mandate, a necessity to build the strongest company and to make the world and the company a healthier, better place. But then there is this complexity about how we're defining diversity. And there's, you know, we've really focused on Black American and African American and Latinx. But we, you know, there has been discussion with my leadership team about whether we're contemplating fairly sexual diversity. Or, you know, non-binary. Now that's tricky because you can't ask that, nor would
right. Do. And I think it's so new too, like the terminology of people are wrapping their heads around it. I think because African-American individuals have historically been the most marginalized community in the states, that automatically when diversity come up, that is the first thing people think is, okay, we got to get some Black people in here. But now there's so many different issues around diversity, sexual orientation, how do the people identify? And then depending on what state you're in, you may not be able to ask that on an application, you know? So that's the hard part. There are legal issues that come up too, because if you do interview someone who was a diverse candidate, whatever their diversification may be, and you don't hire them, is there an issue around, you know, refusing to give them a job opportunity based on how they identify?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you have to be very careful.
Absolutely. No, I think you'll know a lot more about this, obviously. And it's going to be, it is, and I agree, we have the least trouble in identifying our point of view and our goals on hiring, hiring Black employees. Used to be women, now 90% of my company is women. So that used to be in other companies I've run. But this one's, that's not our problem. But, and then there's also ensuring equal promotion opportunity, and so equal pay is pretty easy. I've published those numbers because I think we all should, across the board at certain, you know, levels. I don't publish what people make because that would be tough, but I do publish the bands, like, you know, are we equal across all race and genders representation? And, but I think what gets tricky is the drop off sometimes in the middle levels, for diverse candidates. Cause you're like, cool, I hired, you know, cool. I checked the box, but then who ends up in the boardroom at the end of the day? Like who ends up in the executive suite and what happens in that middle ground? Like how are you tracking and ensuring that you're true to your mission, that you're true to your word. And so there's a lot in there that I imagine is going to, and is already spawning a legal conversation.
Yeah. And well, I can already just tell that you're an amazing human being, because not every business owner that I've come across is even thinking that way. Generally, and this has been the case with huge companies, they're just thinking, okay, well, we need to diversify our candidate pool. And normally that could be, you know, at the very entry level, but are we seeing those diverse candidates move up, like you said, to the C-suite? where they have the ability to actually shape the company in a way that will reach
yes.
a vast majority of people, you know, mm-hmm. which I feel like is a plus for the company.
Right.
But sometimes
Absolutely.
It could be those internal biases mm-hmm. that are keeping individuals from recognizing that something needs to be done. Something has yep. to be fixed because they don't yep. believe or see that it's broken. So yep. I definitely appreciate you for taking that step forward and seeing it through each level, because it is something that we need to start doing at every company in mm-hmm. this country. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I definitely commend you for that. For sure. Yeah,
well, I'm with you, though. It makes it better. You know, I feel like it's so important that every mission that we pursue, that you can prove in the United States, you can prove there's a profitable reason to do it. Because otherwise it ends up being only the people with a conscience or a, you know, PR worry who seem to step forward. And it's really easy to see how much better content is, which is the business we work in, and, you know, community is, when there are a lot of different perspectives in the room. And so much, many things that I've learned from being called out or educated by people I work with. But if we don't also make space for those conversations inside of the office, then these are friends of mine have pointed this out to me who spend a lot of more time in their roles, like one of whom runs Equality Now. She's like, look at who speaks in the room. Like, look at who, like, once you get in the room, you don't give yourself a big pat on the back for hiring diverse employees and then watching them, you know, feel uncomfortable in the room, lose confidence, feel imposter syndrome. And as you rise, there's fewer and fewer of those you identify with. And so the voice gets quieter and quieter, and you get to levels where, you know, everyone in the room is not on your side, I think. Or so I really think this is a complexity that to your earlier, you know, discussion of entry all the way through and what happens, like what is the career pathing, where do things drop off, what is it? And sometimes it's really interesting, like with women retreating in this incredibly disturbing way during COVID, retreating from the workforce, and in particular women of color, it's that, you know, one of the insights was that it's care for elders that really came up, and that role just fundamentally falls to women. And, you know, certainly care of children, which we kind of know, but then you can contemplate that COVID was so difficult on, you know, our parents and that, and the generation ahead of, you know, before. And that likewise, just like kids, you know, domestic responsibilities haven't changed that much when it gets into push comes to shove. It's one or the other. Like one of us gets to go to the office, if, you know, or one of us has to sit here and do math that we don't remember how to do. And we're Googling pre-cal because we don't ever. Anyway, it's yeah, there's so much to unpack in there and just discuss. So I'm glad you
had this conversation. Yeah. Just pay attention to your company culture, because even with the diversification, if the company culture, that environment is not conducive to the growth of the person who's there, then they won't stay long term. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So here's my next question for you. I don't want to keep you all day, but but I do love talking to you.
Thank you.
What are, so this is how I phrase this question. It's basically a football analogy. Like, what have been the four downs to success for you in life? So normally there are things that happen for us and to us throughout our life. It could be something that you thought was a failure that turned into actually be a plus, you know, in hindsight. Mm-hmm. But what have been those things? It doesn't have to be a whole lot, but generally about four things that you feel were pivotal to the success that you have now, or at least have achieved now mm-hmm. at this point in your life.
Okay, I'm writing them down. So I'd say one was getting into the web business in 95. So it was really early. I stumbled into like an office manager job because it paid 25 grand and I was in publishing making 18. And so it was I could live without, you know, scrounging from roommates, like take I don't know. No, I was plenty privileged. I wasn't going to starve, but I moved to my internet gaming company that I didn't even know what the internet was. We didn't have it at home. It was, but moving into that industry that was so nascent, and again, not with any real intentionality. It was, you know, an extra $7,000, and cool people who looked cool, and there was a dog in the office, and it was all the cliches. But that was fundamental because no one had experience in digital, meaning in the office. Even there were really smart people, and there were definitely people who knew how to code, but the rest of us were all kind of beginners, regardless of how much experience we had. So that was like a really flattened org structure that would not have appeared in any other industry, I don't think, at that time. So I was able to do a lot, like to start with, you know, office management and get into marketing and sales and, you know, really quickly. And if you worked really hard, and we did, because it was our life. And so I think starting in an industry that was really at its beginning, then there's the other practical part that when companies, like I went then to CNET and Disney, were looking to hire people that were just a very small pool. So we were like, I'm really an expert in that thing because I've done it for 18 months. And so that was one thing. Another was working within that entrepreneurial environment. I had just immediately a boss friend, challenger, who's become, you know, a very, very long-term friend and godmother to my daughter, and you know, very successful business person who was really hard to work for, really hard, but also toughened me up a lot. And we were both children and made bad decisions, but were also really there for each other and loyal. And so that was, showed me that the benefit of finding people who kind of had your back, or who were, you know, who saw you in like that teammate way of like, your win is my win, and like a lot of passing and a lot of, you know, a lot of assists. So that was another, was finding the people. I had a huge, I only have three, but my, or that I am conjuring right now. The third would be huge fail, hashtag fail, on the company of my dreams. That was the company I was with prior to She Media. It was called Recycle Bank, and it was a clean tech sustainability startup. I was chief revenue and marketing officer, and it was backed by all the best investors. And the idea was that we could reward people with digital points for taking sustainable actions, increasing their recycling, you know, using less water. But it was a wildly difficult model to scale. Like, if I had understood anything, I would have looked at that business, you know, based on the metrics and seen that there was zero path to profit, and we'd already raised $300 million. So it was not going to work. But I didn't, I was just like, oh, I believe everybody, and this sounds wonderful, and of course it's going to be incredibly successful. So I like bled through my eyes for 3 years there trying to make it successful and just thinking if we just brute force. But it was a broken model. It has since, you know, gone away. But that was so devastating. I quit without a plan when it was getting into like, I was having to fire people all over, and we were fundraising on promises I didn't feel comfortable with myself. And it was the first and last time I quit a job without having another job, or without having another job straight up. And I'm really glad I did. So I was super devastated, but ultimately spent, you know, for the first time, spent 6 months, you know, making those Excel spreadsheets about what I wanted to be and where I wanted to work. And that led me to a more thoughtful place. So, but it really sucked. It was really, sorry.
That place was out of alignment for you.
Really was, yeah. Really was out of alignment. And it was, looked so right though, you know. Mm-hmm. It was mission, it was for profit, it was funded by the coolest investors and VCs. We had Al Gore on the board, like, oh my goodness. But what a mismatch, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But look how things that can be dressed up so beautifully could truly just not be.
Just not work. It just doesn't work. Yeah, period. You know, if you don't know how to kick those tires, I didn't at the time.
Right.
But then I learned that. And just like kind of blind faith, I believed everything I heard, which wasn't that anyone's lying. It's more that you don't have the critical thinking.
Well, and they knew how to sell.
Right, right. Exactly.
And if you didn't have the experience,
I was lying. Yeah, right. I was like, that's the company I wanted it to be. Like I had then like developed the critical thinking and the idea that I could actually purchase, you know, perhaps it was all men, the other thing, yeah, that I could perhaps see something that was like, oh wait, that thing you're saying doesn't play out on paper. Like there is no path to margin increase by a 500%, which would be necessary in order to handle the COGS. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
that's what so they wanted, but they couldn't make it yeah. make that happen.
No. Nope.
So here's my last question for you for today, so you don't yell at me for keeping you forever.
No, I love talking to you. It's such fun.
I love talking to you. It's so much fun. So this is the massive question, the title of this show, What Are You Sporting About? You've done so much. The missions that you currently have are absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. If that's your sport, cool. I'm good mm-hmm. with that too. But if there's other things, I would love to know what it is that you're sporting about and how I may actually be able to help you to continue sporting.
There's lots you could do for me. Lots. No, but so I do have one which is within my work space and the boards I work with and different collaborators is I am trying to move or to work with others to move sponsorship and ad dollars into the hands of those who have been underrepresented in receiving those dollars. So by way of example, really, there are almost no Black-owned, women-owned, Latinx-owned publications in the country that make more than that would be more than small business. Most Black-owned, Latinx-owned newspapers, radio stations have all been acquired, or they're no longer Black-owned, or Latin-owned, or women-owned. It's the most conspicuous of Black-owned. So media, that is Black-owned media. There's very little. And so advertising, you know, and the $700 billion that's being spent to fund Facebook, Google, Amazon, you know, all of the platforms that now consume and take all those ad dollars out of the market. Those dollars are how publishers and media companies produce profit. They need the ad dollars. The ad 70% of the ad dollars go to the social platforms who have little to no responsibility for the content they're making, and they're all owned by, you know, the few, including the boards and investors. So what I'm sporting about is with those, you know, $700 billion plus dollars, what if you contemplated putting 10% of that against or into women and diversely owned media, which includes women athletes who are media in a way, you know, especially now that you can say it's not just those who are watching the show. It's not just the audience generated during the show. It's also the audience that that individual generates through all the other media she can produce. And saying to Nike, like, it's not just about sponsoring an athlete. It's where are you running all those ads? And they've really stepped forward. A lot of companies have made very public commitments about how they're going to spend their ad dollars with diversely owned media. But now is the time where we kind of track it, see if it is happening. There's a lot of tension and friction in this space, you know, where advertisers say it's too hard. There's a company I'm working with called Group Black, who's really focused on funnel and doing a very good job at getting commitments from advertisers to funnel dollars into the hands of the podcasters, the creators, the publishers who are, in that case, Black-owned and being really deliberate. So I'd say that's what I'm sporting about right now is allowing or really like holding advertising accountable for what it funds.
I love that. And you just took me to school on a lot of that. Yes, because I didn't know that, you know, I mean, I know that there's advertisement on social media platforms like Facebook, you know, LinkedIn and other places, but I didn't know that it was literally almost kind of monopolizing.
No, totally. Yeah.
You know,
it's defending journalism and like original content in a way that I get it. It's like a tech platform that enables us to do other stuff, but it's the advertisers who are have no, like, it's like by moving your dollars all over there next to the pictures of my puppy or whatever, where like I, or my kids, putting your ad dollars there means you're not putting them somewhere else where, and you're, you know, you're not putting them into an environment that has any accountability for the downstream effect. And because they're so big, all the dollars go to very few players. And it's, you know, they'll say it's hard to buy with thousands of small sites, publications, et cetera. And what, you know, some of these big advertising players like GroupM is one of the, you know, largest agencies on the planet, and GM has said this, Procter & Gamble has said it, and, you know, Group Black, many of their clients have said, we will make the change. Like, we will ensure that we are publishing how much of our advertising spend is going to diversely owned media so that we don't create a world where there isn't any.
Right. Whereas like the pool of money ends up in one spot and that's it, which to me is like a ripple effect of why smaller companies and then, of course, diverse companies end up having to raise their rates for advertising because they don't have a lot coming in. So they have to try to make something.
Yeah.
Wow. That's something else. That is something else. Well, thank you so much for coming on
to the podcast. It's a pleasure.
Yes,
such a fun way to spend this afternoon.
Absolutely. Where can anyone who is looking for a media company like yours, where can they find you if they need your services?
Well, I think I'm actually easiest probably to find on LinkedIn, and I try to really to respond. And there's also She Media on LinkedIn, or we have, I think, honestly, if I'm being real, going to our like info@shemedia.com is not as effective of a way to find, to navigate. So I love getting incoming inquiries or ideas. So I try to keep up with them on LinkedIn, and I can always refer a person to the right areas of Penske Media, which is, you know, owns Rolling Stone and Variety and Billboard and all these other pubs, or I can funnel within my own company.
Yes. So guys, you heard that. Make sure that you go and check She Media out on LinkedIn. Samantha will respond to you if you send an inquiry there and get you into the right pot of wherever you need to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. So listen, if you are an athlete in business, entrepreneur, someone who's been in business for a long time, I want you to join the new Athletes Making Moves course, which launched March 21st of this year, helping individuals just like you to understand and redefine your identity, properly set up your business, and also increase your protection so that you can boost your bottom line. I am Savanya DeBarros, protector of athletes. And as always, guys, it is such a pleasure to encourage you, educate you, and inspire you to your very next level. Until next time, I'll check you out.
Thanks for joining us this week on What Are You Sporting About podcast. Make sure to visit our website, prosportlawyer.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever your favorite platform is, so you'll never miss a show. And while you're at it, if you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or iHeartRadio. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. If you like the show, you might want to check out our book, What Are You Sporting About? Attorney Savanya DeBarros is available for private consulting at sldebarros.com. And remember, we're here to educate, support, and guide you in your journey to success, because we're all sporting about something.